We turn back now to the seven trumpets of Revelation chapters 8 and 9. We'll look now fairly briefly at the first four trumpets. We could spend a lot of time, of course, reading the history of what took place during that period. And this I don't think we'll need to do. I do suggest, though, that for homework you take out the book Daniel the Revelation by Uriah Smith. And I think that the history as outlined by him covering these first four trumpets is quite accurate, quite clear, and we'll just take the main high points of what he has covered in this book to just familiarize ourselves with what was taking place at that point of time. The first trumpet we find listed in verse 7 of Revelation chapter 8. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and a third part of trees was burned up, and all green grass was burned up. No one needs, of course, to be told that this is a picture of tremendous destruction, as it certainly was, and that this destruction was levelled against the declining power of the pagan Roman Empire. The strong point which impresses my mind, of course, is the fact that the pagan Roman Empire fell by the same procedures that had built it. I think in Puyallup we made the point quite strongly and clearly that down through history, the great nations of this world have all perished by the same procedures that they were built up. In other words, if we take Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, and all the nations since that time, they all rose to power by the use of certain procedures, which certain procedures were the use of force and military might and deception and conspiracies to build their empires. Now, one would think, of course, that mankind would learn a lesson somewhere down the line, that somehow they would see that the continually repeated outworking of man's way of doing things results in total and complete decimation. Now, the Romans, no doubt, were very proud of their glory and power when they came to the pinnacle of their power, and no doubt, like Nebuchadnezzar, thought that they were going to be there forever and forever. But the time came when uncouth barbarians, lacking the culture and education and armor of the Romans, were able to come down and destroy the Roman Empire utterly and completely. Now, when we look at the Church of God, by comparison, we find that it too has a bad track record. Now, let's put it this way. Every kingdom, every political kingdom which has ever risen up has come to nothing. And every movement that God ever raised up also has come to nothing. So when it comes to track record, who has the better record? Neither. But then, we have to recognize that every movement that God has built up has been built up in a different way. In other words, the kingdoms of the world have been built man's way. The movements of God, I just put the word churches for shorter, the churches of God have all been raised up God's way. Yet they still failed, haven't they? So what have we got? What hope have we got if when man builds a kingdom, it falls apart, and when God builds a movement, it also falls apart? What hope do we have of success? Right. Now, the point is this, of course. The facts are that it was not God's way of church building which was the secret of their downfall and failure. It was because the churches made the incredible mistake of turning to man's way of kingdom building, and when they did, then they died, just as these kingdoms did too. So it doesn't matter whether the church a nation or a church begins the right way, which Israel did, of course, as a nation back in the first case. But we think of it more as being a church than a nation. Now, it doesn't matter how the kingdom was built. It depends only after its building on whether it follows God's way or man's way as to whether it shall fall or whether it shall succeed and go on. The Apostolic Church, of course, is perhaps one of the most amazing failures of them all, because they had before them in their own lifetime the spectacle of a Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, being destroyed by the Romans. And that destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of the Romans was a powerful testimony, a living witness to the apostolic believers in the early Christian church of what would happen to them if they, like the Jews, turned to man's way of doing things. And yet in the face of that kind of witness, what did the early Christian church do? They did the same thing. That's frightening, isn't it? Because when you think of those wonderful people who made up the early Christian church, and look at ourselves down here at the end of time, we don't think of ourselves being better than they. Many of them had seen Christ face to face. We haven't even seen a living prophet, let alone Christ himself. They had been endowed with the awesome outpouring of the Holy Spirit. They had worked tremendous miracles of physical, mental, and spiritual restoration. And they knew the power of God. They had heard the voice of Jesus. Not just heard about him, but they had heard the voice of Jesus. And to cap all things off, they had the witness in the fall of Jerusalem of the outworking of the other way. Yet they still went the other way. If they did it, then what is our perpetual danger? We'll do the same. And not until we become totally converted to God's way and dig our stakes in very, very deep, so deep they can't be moved, and determined that nothing will ever move us from God's way. That is our only security against going like all the rest have gone. So then, the first of the trumpets came upon the Roman power as surely as the fall of Jerusalem came upon that great power, and demonstrated that men, both those who suffered the awful judgments of the first trumpet and those who administered the awful judgments of the first trumpet, had not learned the lesson of history which says that those who rise by the sword shall go down by the sword. Let's now read a few facts from the book Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith. Now, I'm not going to recommend this book entirely. I'll demonstrate a little later where Uriah Smith gave us some very misleading points in regard to the River Euphrates. But just for now, I think we can safely look at the history he has written down in regard to the first trumpet. And this first trumpet was the onslaught of the Goths under the leadership of, just get it straight in my mind here again, I have read quite a bit of this today. I think it was Genseric, wasn't it? The first one lost the place. I'll pick it up now. Alaric. Alaric, who led the Goths in 395, or thereabouts, against the mighty Roman Empire. I'll read this now. The first invasion, page 476 in the book Daniel the Revelation, and this, if your paging is different, it's obviously, of course, a commentary on the verse Revelation 8 and verse 7, which deals with the outpouring of that first fearful trumpet. The first invasion under Alaric ravaged the Eastern Empire. He captured the famous cities and enslaved many of the inhabitants. Thrace, Macedonia, Attica, and the Peloponnesus were conquered, but he did not reach the city of Rome. Later, the Gothic chieftain crossed the Alps and the Apennines and appeared before the walls of the Eternal City, which fell a prey to his fury, or the fury of the barbarians, in AD 410. So in a short 15 years, from 395 to 410, he had literally decimated the western part of Rome. Eastern part of Rome, I should beg your pardon, I should say rather, the Eastern Empire. Reading on, hail and fire mingled with blood were cast upon the earth. The terrible effects of this Gothic invasion are represented as hail from the northern origin of the invaders, fire from the destruction by flame of both city and country, and blood from the terrible slaughter of the citizens of the empire by the bold and intrepid warriors. Now, there's several pages now which describe in more detail the fearful slaughter which took place during that period of time, and must have been a tremendous embarrassment to the proud Romans to find themselves completely unable to resist the onslaught of these uncouth barbarians who came sweeping down from the frigid regions of the north. Rome, that mighty power which had wielded her will over every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, was now suffering the very punishments and tortures which she herself had inflicted upon those who were under her power previously. And which, as you sow, so shall you most certainly reap. And I'm so thankful that God's kingdom is built by different principles, and we don't have to worry about coming to our end, because the kingdom that we are involved in our building simply grows brighter and larger and more glorious and more permanent. We can't become more permanent, can we? But it becomes more established and more certain as time goes by. And it is an eternal kingdom which shall never pass away, and that's the kind of kingdom I want to belong to, and you too, of course. Moving on now to the second trumpet, as I'm going to leave you folks to read all this detailed history if you wish to. The main points to see, of course, are the facts that what the Roman Empire sowed, the Roman Empire reaped. Verse 8, and the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and a third part of the sea became blood. What does a mountain in Bible prophecy always symbolize? A kingdom. Very good. And what does the sea symbolize? Peoples. And however, the language tends to be literal here, I think, because the incursions of the second barbarian king were mostly naval. Let's turn now to the book Daniel and the Revelation again, and page 478, I read, "The Roman Empire, after Constantine the Great, was divided into three parts. Hence the frequent remark, 'a third part of men,' is an allusion to the third part of the empire which was under the scourge. This division of the Roman kingdom was made at the death of Constantine among his three sons, Constantius, Constantine the Second, and Constans. The father must have liked his own name, mustn't he? He was called Constantine. He named his three sons Constantius, Constantine the Second, and Constans. You sure he must have liked his own name, mustn't he? Constantius possessed the East and fixed his residence at Constantinople, the metropolis of the empire. Constantine the Second held Britain, Gaul, and Spain. Constans held Illyricum, Africa, and Italy. The sounding of the second trumpet evidently relates to the invasion and conquest of Africa and afterwards of Italy by Genseric, otherwise called Gaiseric, king of the Vandals." Now, of course, that word Vandals still brings down to us that the Vandals back there were so destructive, so wantonly destructive, that the word Vandal still applies to people with that kind of bent. And therefore you can begin to appreciate what kind of folk they must have been back there. They just loved to destroy and to kill and to waste. "His conquests were for the most part naval, and his triumphs were, as it were, a great mountain burning with fire cast into the sea. What figure would better, or even so well, illustrate the collision of navies and the general havoc of war on the maritime coasts? In explaining this trumpet, we are to look for some events that will have a particular bearing on the commercial world. The symbol used naturally leads us to look for agitation and commotion. Nothing but a fierce maritime warfare would fulfill the prediction, and so it proved to be. Now, Genseric reached his height between the years AD 428 and 468. This great Vandal chief had his headquarters in Africa, but as Gibbon states, the discovery and conquest of the black nations in Africa that might draw beneath the torrid zone could not tempt the rational ambition of Genseric. But he cast his eyes toward the sea, he resolved to create a naval power, and his bold resolution was executed with steady and active perseverance." Now, I'm very interested in this statement, because Genseric could very easily have turned his eyes southwards across the mighty Sahara Desert and conquered the whole of Africa and made it his own country. Turned it perhaps into more of a European-style country than it turned out to be. But he ignored the rich and wonderful areas to the south and turned his interest exclusively toward the Roman Empire. And he had to do this because the trumpets were plagues against the Roman Empire. They were not simply and only attempts to gain great wealth and power on the part of these men. And so he built himself a navy. And for the port of Carthage, he repeatedly made piratical sallies, preyed on the Roman commerce, and waged war with that empire. To cope with this sea monarch, the Roman Emperor Majorian made extensive naval preparations. A quote now from, Alexander Keith. The woods of the Apennines were felled. The arsenals and manufactures of Ravenna and Misenum were restored. Italy and Gaul vied with each other in liberal contributions to the public service, and the imperial navy of 300 large galleys with an adequate proportion of transports and smaller vessels was collected in the secure and capacious harbour of Cartagena in Spain. But Genseric was saved from impending and inevitable ruin by the treachery of some powerful subjects, envious or apprehensive of their master's success. Guided by their secret intelligence, he surprised the unguarded fleet in the Bay of Cartagena. Many of the ships were sunk, or taken, or burnt, and the preparation of 3 years was destroyed in a single day. The Kingdom of Italy, a name to which the Western Empire was gradually reduced, was afflicted under the reign of Ricimer by the incessant depredation of the Vandal pirates. In the spring of each year, they equipped a formidable navy in the port of Carthage, and Genseric himself, though in a very advanced age, still commanded in person the most important expedition. The Vandals repeatedly visited the coast of Spain, Liguria, Tuscany, Campania, Lucania, Bruttium, Apulia, Calabria, Venetia, Dalmatia, Epirus, Greece, and Sicily. So I ask you where all those places are? I don't know myself. The ancient place names, of course, have been exchanged for modern place names in these last days. The celerity or speed of their motions enabled them almost at the same time to threaten to attack the most distant objects to the track of their desires, and as they always embarked a sufficient number of horses, they had no sooner landed than they swept the dismayed country with a body of light Celt cavalry. A last and desperate attempt to dispossess the Church of the sovereignty of the seas was made in the year 468 by Leo the First, the Emperor of the East. Gibbon bears witness to this as follows. The whole expanse of the African campaign, by whatsoever means it was defrayed, amounted to a sum of 130,000 pounds of gold, about 5,200,000 pounds sterling, and 5 million, of course, is $10 million. And this was written back when gold was about $10 an ounce, today it's $300 or $400 an ounce. So multiply that figure of 10 million by about 40. And you have something like $4 billion worth of gold. That's what it cost them to build this navy to attempt to stop Ben Sherrick and his depredation. But to cut a long story short, the wily Ben Sherrick manned his largest ships of war with the bravest of the Moors and the Vandals, and they towed after them many large barks filled with combustible material. In the obscurity of the night, these destructive vessels were impelled against the unguarded and unsuspecting fleet of the Romans, who were awakened by the sense of their instant danger. Their close and crowded order assisted the progress of the fire, which was communicated with rapid and irresistible violence, and the noise of the winds, the crackling of the flames, the whistling cries of the soldiers and mariners, who could neither command nor obey, increased the horror of the nocturnal tumult. Whilst they labored to extricate themselves from the fire ship and to save at least a part of the navy, the galleys of Genseric assaulted them with temperate and disciplined valor, and many of the Romans who escaped the fury of the flame were destroyed or taken prisoner by the victorious Vandals. After the failure of this great expedition, Genseric again became the plague of the sea. The coasts of Italy, Greece, and Asia were again exposed to his revenge and avarice. Tripoli in Sardinia returned to his obedience. He added Sicily to a number of his provinces, and before he died, in the fullness of years and glory, he beheld the final extinction of the empires of the West. Some surges, weren't they? As these Vandals and Goths came pouring out from the north and decimated various parts of the great Roman Empire. Now verse 10 of Revelation chapter 8. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became Wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. And the third great onslaught against the Roman Empire came with this third trumpet. Can we read now some thoughts from page 483 of the book again, that is Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith. In the interpretation and application of this passage, we are brought to the third important event which resulted in the subversion of the Roman Empire. In beginning the historical fulfillment of this third trumpet, we shall be indebted to the notes of Albert Barnes for a few extracts. In explaining this scripture, it is necessary, at this, as this commentator says, that there would be some supernal warrior who might be compared with a blazing meteor whose course would be singularly brilliant, who would appear suddenly like a blazing star and then disappear like a star whose light was cast in the waters. But the desolating course of that meteor would be mainly on those portions of the world that abounded with springs of water and running streams. Then the effect would be produced as if those streams and fountains were made bitter, that is, that many persons would perish, and a wide desolation would be caused in the vicinity of those rivers and streams, as if a bitter and baleful star should fall upon the waters and death should spread over the lands adjacent to them and watered by them. And the Attila the Hun, who was one of the fiercest of the barbarian kings to come against the Roman Empire, is the power represented by this third trumpet. You know, as you read these descriptions of that time, I'm certainly glad I did not live in those days out in various parts of the Roman Empire. Although unquestionably, of course, the true people of God were not injured or hurt by this onslaught. It's always been a fact of history that when the king of the north, which is Babylon, is at war with the king of the south, which is atheism, that the people of God remain unscathed by these great struggles. And essentially, of course, a battle between the barbarian hordes, who were atheists in effect, they were aliens and did not believe in the true God, and the Romans, of course, which is Babylon, the king of the north,
was a conflict which left the people of God untouched. The trumpets were not levelled against the people of God any more than the seven last plagues were, but they were levelled against the mighty power of the Roman Empire. Now, a quote now from Barnes again. In the manner of his appearance, he strongly resembled a brilliant meteor flashing in the sky. He came from the east, gathering his tongues, and poured them down, as we shall see, with the rapidity of a flashing meteor suddenly on the empire. He died himself also as devoted to Mars, the god of war, and was accustomed to array himself in a peculiar, brilliant manner, so that his appearance and the language of his flatteries were such as to dazzle the eyes of beholders. That's in a very vain dilettante, must he not? And to sum this whole thing up, it says, the whole breadth of Europe, as it extends above 500 miles from the Euxine to the Adriatic, was at once invaded and occupied and desolated by the myriads of barbarians whom Attila led into the field. And it was an extremely bitter experience for the survivors still left in the Roman Empire. I turn now to the fourth trumpet, verse 12 of Revelation chapter 8. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Now, these three divisions, according to Uriah Smith, point to three great governmental positions in the Roman Empire, Roman government. One, the emperors;
two, the senators; and three, the consuls. And in the attack made by Odoacer, I think he was a Visigoth member, rightly, doesn't quite say it here yet, it will shortly, no doubt. But I think that Odoacer was a Visigoth. And in the attack made by him, he did, while he dispossessed the emperor of his position, he did pay respect to the other two institutions, so that only one third of the power of the Roman Empire was smitten by this particular leader during this period of time. Once again, I'll leave you to read the rather extensive notes in the he was the chief of the Heruli. Odoacer was the chief of the Heruli, a barbarian remnant of the host of Attila, left on the Alpine frontiers of Italy, interposed with his command that the name and the office of the Roman Emperor of the West should be abolished, but he left the other two offices intact. I like this little poem on page 491. The fearful ravages of these barbarian hordes who, under their bold but cruel and desperate leaders, devastated Rome, are vividly portrayed in the following spirited lines. And then a deluge of wrath it came, and the nations shook with dread, and swept the earth with fields of flame, and piled with the mingled dead. Kings were rolled in the wasteful flood, with a low and crouching slave, and together lay in a shroud of blood the coward and the brave. So what a picture of judgment this was upon the haughty might of Imperial Rome. I've only tried to give you a very brief picture of that destructive onslaught. And if you wish to follow that further, of course, you can take time out to read the descriptions given in the book by Uriah Smith. So much then for the fearful sufferings which were inflicted upon Rome. And now, in the face of this witness, another witness of what is the outworking of human endeavor when men build kingdoms by the sword, the papacy arose to do it all over again. The papacy arose to demonstrate that they had learned nothing from the lessons of the past. Now let's just look now at the dating of all this to see how inexcusable the papacy was to go ahead to build a kingdom as had been built back there in the past. Now the onslaught of the barbarians was completed by the year 476 AD. And by that time we find that Europe has been split now into 10 kings. We read about four of them in particular here. There are four great ones, under Attila and Odoacer and the other two, which we read there before. And the papacy, of course, did not achieve power as a king until 538 AD, which, of course, was something like 62 years after the decimation of the Roman Empire. So therefore, when the papacy rose to power, the destruction of the Roman Empire was very, very fresh in their mind and should have been a lesson which they should never have forgotten. What do we find the papacy doing? The papacy sets about to build a kingdom by using the same methods as pagan Rome had done, because, as you read in Revelation 13, that the beast gave to the papacy his seat and his power and great authority. And by the same procedures, the papacy did the same thing all over again, even though the lesson was very, very fresh in their minds and right there before their faces. Now, when a people, such as the papists as in this case, rise up and do the same thing as the wicked of the past, in the full light of the punishment falling upon the wicked of the past, then are they not more guilty than the people of the past? Aren't they? Very, very much so. Very much so. And therefore, we must expect to find even more terrible judgments falling upon the papal system than fell upon the pagan system. And when finally, of course, Babylon the Great arises down in the last days with all the history of the past before them, they'll have no excuse at all to institute an organization based upon human plan-making and human problem-solving. No excuse whatsoever. And therefore, their punishment in the seven last plagues will outclass the punishment experienced by, first of all, pagan Rome, and then secondly, by papal Rome. Let's move on then to the fifth trumpet, which does not take place now for a long, long time. We'll find that it's way down toward the end of the Middle Ages, around in the 16 and 1700s, whereas all this took place before we come to 1,000 years, so it's over 1,000 years later that the next trumpet descends in fury upon the papal system. And in the meantime, of course, the papal system had been built. Here we find the papacy. It had been built, and we find the seed and the growth and the maturity of that system. Now, thinking in nature, what is the next word which I must place? The sowing of the seed, the growth, it comes to maturity, what then? Right, harvest. Okay, we come to the harvest, and the harvest, as we're learning now, of course, came over 1,000 years later during the when the Mohammedan hordes, once again, of course, the king of the south, arose to attack the Roman Empire, and did so very, very effectively. I mean, the papal Roman Empire, of course, in this particular context. Let's turn now to Revelation 9. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pits. Now, I'm not altogether satisfied with all Uriah Smith's interpretations of the fifth trumpets, and I don't plan to read too much from him, therefore, in regard to this. I'd like, though, to first of all look at the star which fell from heaven. There's a reference to a star back in the third trumpet, in the 10th verse of the previous chapter. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. Now, primarily, who must this star be? Satan. It must be Satan. Because, as we read in Revelation, the first chapter, Jesus Christ holds the seven stars in his right hand, and the seven stars symbolize the angels of the churches, and Lucifer originally was an angel, and therefore he became a fallen star when he fell from heaven above down to this earth. I think I mentioned before the simple fact that in this world there are only three powers. They are Babylon, Egypt, and Israel. Now you may say, what about all the other nations like Germany and America and Australia and so forth? Those countries all come under one of these three classifications. Now, Babylon is professed religion. Babylon is man's attempt to build God's kingdom man's way. Babylon is very religious. Professes to serve the true God, is not atheistic, and in the Bible is called the King of the North, and is symbolized by ancient Babylon, again by pagan Rome and then papal Rome, and today by apostate Protestantism, as it rules over the world. That's the King of the North. Egypt is atheism. Now, it's the kind of atheism which worships false gods in the place of the true God. It's not the kind of atheism which denies all gods. Because back in Egypt, of course, they had many, many gods. Sun gods and moon gods and star gods and harvest gods and rain gods and all kinds of gods. But they denied the existence and authority of the true God. And that made them atheists in Bible classification. Now, down through history, so far, I should mention Israel, of course. Now, Israel, of course, is the truth of God. Israel is where men seek to build God's kingdom, God's way. Atheism seeks to build man's kingdom, man's way. Babylon, God's kingdom, man's way. Now, as I was about to say, down through history, one or the other of these three powers has ruled the world. In the days of Moses and the children of Israel, obviously, of course, Egypt ruled the world at that point of time, and Babylon didn't seem to figure very much in the picture. But with the fall of Babylon and the deliverance of God's people and their entry into the promised land, then literally Israel became the dominant military and political power upon the face of the earth, and certainly the dominant religious power. And if Israel had been faithful to God, then Babylon would never ever have been able to rise to a position of world dominion. But with the falling away of God's people after Solomon's apostasy, which we studied last year, we find that Babylon rose to a position of world dominion. So now the king of the north rules the world, and while she does, where is the king of the south, or Egypt? It's out of the picture, isn't it? At that time, Egypt didn't amount to anything. And what about God's people? When we saw that when Egypt ruled the world, where were God's people? In slavery. When Babylon ruled the world, where were God's people? Back in slavery once again. And then God delivered Israel with the breaking of Babylon's power, and they were given the right to again build the city and the temple. But with their repeated apostasy, we find that Rome then comes to rule the world, and when Rome rules the world, where again are God's people? Back in bondage or slavery. The mighty resurgence of Christianity in the Apostolic Church, of course, once again gave the Church of God a predominant place, but apostasy robbed them of their power, and now the papacy ruled the world. Now, notice an interesting pattern here. Now, I just put it down on the board, E for Egypt, in the days of Moses and the Exodus. Then, of course, we have Israel, with both Egypt and Babylon down. Israel falls away in Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar's day rules the world. Then came Medo-Persia, which was a Babylonian system, Greece, which is a Babylonian system, Rome, which is a Babylonian system, the rise of the Apostolic Church, and this falling away, the papacy, which is a Babylonian system, then the rise of atheism in the, I should put the Aryans back here, of course, the barbarians, I forgot them, which of course are the, which were atheists. So we have the barbarians, and after the papacy we have the rise of atheism in revolutionary France. But in these last days we find that the last manifestation of satanic power will again be Babylon. Now, of the systems that Satan has employed, and those two systems are Egypt and Babylon, which has been in the driving seat in world affairs the most? Egypt or Babylon? Babylon has been. And the only reason why Satan turns to atheism now and again is because he has no other alternative. Now, Babylon, of course, is Satan's way, the expression of Satan's way, because Satan wants to build God's kingdom. Yes, he surely does, but his own way. Satan does not wish to deny the existence and power of God. He only desires to deny the existence and power of Jesus Christ and to put himself in the place of Jesus Christ. So when we read about the star falling from heaven in Revelation 9, and this star having the key to the bottomless pit out of which atheism comes, then we have to recognize that Satan is resorting to the power of atheism only because at this point of time he had no other power to do the work which he desired them to do. Now, this may sound strange because we find Satan's kingdom warring against Satan's kingdom, but that is the peculiar perversity of Satan's mind. People often question that because it's so illogical for Satan to behave the way he is. But let me read you from Great Controversy, page 36, where Sister White tells us that Satan's own people have great cause for gratitude to God for God's protecting them against their own master. Page 36 in the book Great Controversy. The disobedient and unthankful have great reason for gratitude for God's mercy and long-suffering in holding in check the cruel, malignant power of the evil one. But when men pass the limits of divine forbearance, that restraint is removed. Now, on whose side are the disobedient and the unthankful? Satan's side. Now, that class of people have great reason for gratitude for God's mercy in holding back the destructive power of Satan. In other words, Satan's own friends depend upon God to protect them from their master. Incredible, isn't it? What sort of perverted mind must Satan have when he actually sets out to destroy his own people? Now, it was Satan, of course, who brought the 10 plagues upon Egypt. It was Satan, therefore, who broke the power of the Egyptians. But why did he do it? Because he hoped that he could, by destroying the Egyptians, also involve the Israelites in the same destruction and take them all out together. And if he could destroy the Israelites, either cost him the entire kingdom of Egypt, he would do it just to get rid of the Israelites. Because Satan knew that if he could destroy the royal line, that Christ could never come to this earth and his kingdom would therefore be secure. Now, the bottomless pits in the Word of God is a symbol of that place from which atheism ascends. Let's go across to Revelation chapter 11 for a moment to confirm this. Revelation chapter 11. And we find in, there's a verse again, verse 7, in regard to the two witnesses, which are the Old and the New Testament. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them. I don't have time now to prove this point, or they can prove it by simply turning to Great Controversy, page 265, where Sister White flatly says that this beast in the bottomless pit was atheism, as manifest in the reaction which took place in page 269, my mistake, page 269, Great Controversy. And there Sister White plainly says that the beast from the bottomless pit was atheism, which rose up as a mighty reaction against the Roman Catholic system in France, revolutionary France. And when we come across to Revelation 20, we find that another being has the key of the bottomless pits, and this being, of course, is Jesus Christ. Maybe it could well be, of course, that the star referred to in Revelation 9 is the star fell from heaven, and Christ certainly never fell from heaven unto the earth. The being who fell from heaven unto the earth, of course, is Satan. Christ that comes down from heaven, he doesn't fall from heaven. No way in the world does Christ do that. Now, the angel that we read about in Revelation 20, verse 1, who comes down from heaven, doesn't fall, but comes down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, he lays hold upon Satan and chains him up for 1,000 years. Now, when Satan now is chained up in the bottomless pit, we've come to that point of time when no more pretense exists so far as apostate people are concerned. When the voice of God turned the captivity of his people before the close of probation, and the wicked saw the real nature of the deception practiced upon them, and of course the king of the north literally ceased to exist, and men were shown to be disbelievers in God, which they actually were. And so this earth then has become the burial ground of millions upon millions of people. I shouldn't say the burial ground, the resting place, because they're not buried. It's the resting place of millions and millions of unburied dead, from whom has been stripped every guise of pretense, every appearance of their being the king of the north, and they're all shown to be disbelievers in the God of heaven. And it is therefore into this place of unbelief in God, this dreary earth, that Satan is chained for 1,000 years of desperate contemplation of what he has brought upon the human family and what he's done to the beautiful kingdom of God. And certainly, of course, I couldn't envy his misery and desperation during that 1,000 years of meditation. So then Revelation 9 shows that the opening of the bottomless pit with this key is the release of enormous atheistic powers that sweep over the earth and go to war against the king of the north, but not against the people of God. As verse 4 plainly says, they were not to hurt those men which have not, they will hurt only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. In actual fact, as we shall see a little later in our presentations, the Protestant church or the Christian people in Europe were tremendously blessed by the invasions of the Mohammedan hordes from the east toward the west. Let's read now verse 1 and 2 to close our study period. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth of power, and was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months, and their torment was as a torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. Right, we'll leave it there now for the study period, as time has gone, and we'll